Ultra Beast United.
From ICE. Doing this shit for quite some time, man. It's a Loudmouth Hooligan reunion.
Baking it until you make it is Ferrari Mike's specialty. He wants to show his potential victims that he rubs elbows with the biggest stars in hip-hop. And mansions, fancy cars, even renting Ludacris's private plane to fly in. Of course, Mike Banuelos is a showman. Previously on Tax Crime Junkies, we painted a vivid picture of Michael's elaborate scams. Banuelos admitted that he falsely told the business manager of a musical group that Banuelos had arranged a concert tour during which the musical group would open for a famous recording artist. You may have heard of him, Ludacris. In addition, Banuelos falsely told this business manager that Banuelos had negotiated a multi-million dollar contract with a major recording label. Banuelos falsely told this business manager that he had negotiated a multi-million dollar contract with a major recording label, Def Jam Records, for the rights to the music group. And Ferrari Mike produced phony documentation of that alleged deal. He also used fake statements and phony documents to lure in additional investors in this purported music deal and other non-existent deals regarding musical artists. Several of the investors in these deals lived in the Bay Area, California. Ferrari Mike admitted that of the more than $2 million he obtained through this scheme, he spent the overwhelming majority of it on personal expenses. Those expenses included payments to his ex-wife, scores of thousands of dollars on car payments, and thousands of dollars paid for a country club membership and dues. Finally, he admitted that after the music deal scam ended, he defrauded other individuals out of an additional $217,000. With that scheme, he falsely claimed that he was a successful money manager who one client had entrusted with $45 million for investment. You should never trust that guy. He provided false documentation of these claims as well, resulting in additional victims providing more money to Banuelos in the mistaken belief it would be invested on their behalf. Today, we're going to continue our story about Ferrari Mike Banuelos. And hold on to your seats, folks, because it's a doozy. You won't believe his previous career. Welcome back, everyone, to Tax Crime Junkies. I'm your host, Dominique. I'm a CPA, certified tax strategist. I have an interest in true crimes. I have a degree in law and lead the American Institute of Certified Tax Planners. And with me today is my oh-so-lovable co-host, Tom Gorzinski.
Hey, Dom. I'm Tom Gorzinski. I'm an enrolled agent. I've admitted to practice before the U.S. Tax Court as a non-attorney. I'm a tax instructor, and like you, I have a real interest in true crime. We decided to create a true crime podcast to combine our love of mysteries, whodunits, and tax. We are the Tax Crime Junkies. In today's episode, we're going to unveil part two of our investigation into the case of Michael Banuelos, a man who spent over 15 years evading a day's honest work and instead devoted his time to elaborate schemes. What was his ultimate goal? To live a life of luxury and excess. But here's the twist. None of it was real. He fabricated ownership of lavish homes and luxurious cars, creating an illusion of wealth. In the midst of his deception, he operated under various company names, luring aspiring musicians with false promises of incredible success. It was all a facade. Instead of fulfilling his promises to all these people, he swindled investors out of a staggering $3 million, using their hard-earned money to fund his own personal expenses.
And I just want to get back to the victims here, Tom, because we talked about several of victims of Ferrari Mike's scams last time, including two teenage boys in a duo called High Life. And we also talked about an artist called Four Eyes. And what they have in common is they had dreams of making it big in the music industry. And Mike, of course, exploited their aspirations. He led them on with false promises. He took their money. In fact, we're featuring the music of Four Eyes and High Life throughout today's episode, so we hope you enjoy. And where we're at now is a San Francisco jury has indicted him for wire fraud and for money laundering. And guess where they arrested him? Chicago. Turns out he had recently relocated there after living in and around Atlanta for quite some time. That's not that big of a shocker. I think these scammers have to kind of keep on the go.
Right.
People guessing about where they actually are located. So Michael Banuelo stands before the court awaiting sentencing for the fraud that caused significant financial and emotional loss to this group of investors and artists. And he acknowledged the hardship that he caused. He said that he understood that he would receive a prison sentence for his actions, but he requests the court to consider mitigating factors in his case. And that's pretty common, but here's his position. Given the gravity of his offense and his track record, both the probation officer and the government agreed. They wanted him to do a 63-month prison sentence followed by 3 years of probation on a supervised release. They weren't seeking any fines, but when you take money from people, restitution is always on the table. And so he'd have to do that. And then they always throw in this special assessment fee of $100. I guess that's just to tip you over the edge.
Exactly. But let's start from the beginning. And this may be unbelievable, but it's true. When he was in his 20s, he was a deputy sheriff in Los Angeles. Now, this is where things took a shocking turn. When he was serving as a deputy sheriff, he ran an investment fraud scheme right under everyone's noses. It targeted his own colleagues. He had the audacity to claim he was a wealthy investor working as a sheriff's deputy as a hobby. Now, I come from a law enforcement family. No one looks at a law enforcement job as a hobby, in my opinion. It's crazy, right?
Yeah, this blew my mind, Tom. Law enforcement?
Yeah, well, he's still a scammer. Under the guise of a real estate deal involving the renovation of an office building in New York, he convinced his fellow deputies to invest their hard-earned money. He promised, of course, substantial profits, he always does, returns of up to $60,000 in just a few months based on investments as small as $2,500. Now, to you and me, they might not sound reasonable or believable, but unfortunately, his coworkers fell for the tactic. And he ended up defrauding them of over $100,000. He was convicted in 1997 of grand theft and left the sheriff's office in disgrace. Now, if that's not bad enough, hold on. The story didn't end there. After relocating to another part of the country, and we see a theme again of him moving from place to place to place, he continued his fraudulent activities. He was arrested in 1999 for using counterfeit checks to obtain thousands of dollars in credit. And if that wasn't enough, in 2001, he found himself in trouble for forgery, even though no charges were filed. He couldn't stop deceiving and cheating people. And there's even more. Several women have come forward with reports of physical abuse at his hands. His second wife revealed he had once grabbed her by the throat. He had smashed her head into a mirror. On another occasion, he threw her into wooden furniture. This pattern of abuse didn't end there. His former girlfriend and his third wife also experienced similar violence. Unbelievably disturbing pattern of behavior from him.
I'll say, and I have to say, you know, knowing what we know about Ferrari Mike, it's actually not that surprising. But what was even more alarming was his propensity for lying and manipulating everyone around him. And we can see this with the abuse victims as well, because, of course, he's denying what happened. All the women who encountered him shared stories of his continuous deceit. He'd lie about his law enforcement past, his employment history, his financial situation, of course. And this is way back when. So it's interesting to see this arc and how he developed and improved in his schemes over time. You can see that he starts out with some lower amounts of what he swindled from his law enforcement colleagues, $100,000, and then the schemes get more and more sophisticated and the dollar amounts get higher as well. The probation report was filled with accounts from people who had been repeatedly lied to by Ferrari Mike throughout really his entire adult life. One of his ex-wives shared a detailed account of some of his actions. She was showing that she was frustrated with how he manipulated the legal system to his advantage. He had a knack for taking people's money, and he was making it very difficult for people to recover it. As I mentioned with the restitution, I mean, it's kind of a fat chance that you're ever going to get paid back. When the person that is guilty of these crimes can't be trusted. So he's not going to be able to pay you back, and he's not going to take that seriously enough. And so most victims, of course, had lost all this money, and they eventually just give up because they can't afford legal help. But in this particular case, one victim refused to let go because the money that Benuelos had taken belonged to her and her parents. And it didn't just stop there. He wasn't just a financial fraudster. As you mentioned, he had this physical abuse streak as well. And it wasn't just physical. He was also the culprit of emotionally abusing multiple women. And the person in this story really talked about these allegations, and they found her credible because they came from a lot of different sources who had provided consistent accounts of that abuse. And even this person's own father had passed away without receiving the alimony that was owed to him by Benuelos. So she pointed out that he was indiscriminate in his actions, preying on anyone he encountered, regardless of their vulnerability. But you can imagine that those who are most vulnerable is who he was drawn to. He even manipulated bank presidents into approving fraudulent loans. And his actions had caused bankruptcies and really shattered a lot of lives. This guy was just leaving wreckage in his path. So what happens, Tom, is victims often get to testify at sentencing. They're usually able to make a statement. And for those who just don't want to participate in those proceedings, perhaps they might be fearful of someone like a Mike Benuelos that was physically abusive to them. And in those cases, the court will allow victims generally to submit letters asking for what they'd like to see happen. The victim in this case strongly believed that what the prosecution was recommending, 41 to 63 months, she didn't feel that was sufficient given how severe his crimes were and how many people were affected by him. And so she requested a longer sentence. She wanted like 96 to 144 months as a fair and just outcome.
Good for her. That I think that's reasonable for all the damage he's done throughout his life. You know, 41 to 63 months just doesn't cut it, in my opinion.
Right. Well, and then you think of, it's not just about punishing for those crimes, right? It's about protecting society. And this person is a danger to society. He's got a pattern that he's established. He not only hurts people he doesn't know, but he hurts people in his inner circle as well. And in this case, this ex-wife shared how this guy's actions also impacted her children's lives. It hindered their future. It left them emotionally scarred. So here she is. She's pleading with the court so that they will see through the false image that Ferrari Mike has gotten really good at portraying. And she wanted the court to know, listen, he doesn't have empathy. And you can see that in this guy's actions. He doesn't care who he harms. And of course, she knew that his family might present a very different picture of this criminal, but she assured the court that they didn't truly know the real Mike Banuelos. And despite all the evidence and the testimonies against him, of course, Mike Banuelos played the blame game. It's never the defendant's fault. He's pointing fingers at others instead of just owning up to his own misdeeds. And I think the court sees enough of these cases that they kind of recognize what to listen for in a defendant's allocution about why should they have mercy on this particular person. He blamed his failed marriages on the wives, and he alleged mental health issues and alcohol abuse. He even tried to paint himself as the victim, claiming that his third wife was the one who was physically abusive, despite the stark contrast in size between the two of them.
There is really no indication that he truly understood the gravity of what he did, or that he really had any respect for the law. Even when he was employed by law enforcement, he shamelessly used that position to cheat his colleagues and line his own pockets. His pattern of fraudulent behavior was before his time as a deputy sheriff, and after his time as a deputy sheriff, and even during his time as a deputy sheriff. Now, during the trial, the defendant was represented by his attorney, John Jordan. He submitted a sentencing memorandum to aid the court in making its final decision. This memorandum served as a plea for the court's consideration of the mitigating factors in his case. Now, Ferrari Mike stood before the court fully aware of what was going on. He acknowledged what he had done had caused significant financial and emotional harm to a group of investors. He understood he would face the consequences of his actions or the prison sentence, but he earnestly asked the court to take into account certain things to mitigate his culpability. The defendant presented some factors he believed should be taken into consideration. The defense raised objections to the pre-sentence investigation report. But what was that report and why was it so important?
Well, we've looked at a lot of cases now, Tom, and what we see is there are these pre-sentence reports or federal sentencing memorandums. And what happens is both sides are offered the opportunity to write a sentencing memorandum to help persuade a judge, either in the case of the defense, that the lowest possible sentence is appropriate. In the case of the probation department writing, and then usually the prosecution gives some input on that as well. From the probation standpoint, what they're doing is looking at the nature of the crimes, and they're making recommendations about a likelihood of reoffending and taking into consideration things like protecting the public from the aggressiveness or the violence of the defendant, for example. And there are standards that they follow depending on which court of law you're in. Some courts use scoring systems to rank the seriousness of the offense. And then what you see is on the defense side, they will want to then bring in kind of mitigating circumstances. They'll give a fuller picture of the defendant's life. It's got critical information about the defendant's background, the criminal history that's there. And so we're talking about Ferrari Mike much earlier in his life, but you can imagine what the PSR showed by the time we get around to when he ripped off High Life and when he ripped off Four Eyes. Now he's got sort of this extensive criminal history that's adding up, and the court evaluates that, and they look at what's called a guideline range for sentencing, and that is what ultimately helps the court determine the appropriate length of the sentence itself. And of course, the defense counsel is going to raise objections. They're going to object not only to the sentencing time itself, but also to things like restitution. So they're going to counter the loss amount that's attributed to the defendant. And so in this case, it's no different. Ferrari Mike's defense argued that the calculation was not correct. And we see this a lot with IRS cases as well. Oftentimes what will happen is a good defense attorney will come in and poke holes in the calculations where the IRS criminal division has added up the total losses. So they dispute as much as they possibly can to get that restitution amount as low as they possibly can, despite the fact that realistically, they're probably never going to collect that restitution, yet it is really hanging out there.
You know, but that wasn't all. The defense also raised other objections to figures that were in the loss calculation. They argued that certain amounts should be excluded because they were returned prior to the discovery of the offense.
There it goes.
Right? The defense believed that these figures were wrongly included. Now, if you include those figures, they claimed it led to an improper two-level increase in the offense level. And of course, the higher the offense level, the higher the sentencing guidelines range is. So the more they can chip away at it, the more the guidelines reduce the potential prison sentence, which is really what this is all about. One objection that stood out was the inclusion of the 2006 Bannon media allegations. The defense argued that those allegations were uncharged criminal conduct, and they actually shouldn't be considered relevant to the current offense. They asserted that the pre-sentencing report couldn't expand the scope of the charged offense conduct. The defense also asserted that including these allegations resulted in an incorrect calculation of the offense level and the defendant's criminal history. Now, the defense also delved into Ferrari Mike's personal history. The pre-sentence report revealed tragic loss at a young age with the passing of his mother. He was fortunate to have a stable family environment, and his brother Gerald took on a fatherly role in his life. He was able to complete education and attend and graduate high school.
So this is sort of how this works. You know, it is like a debate. You've got mitigating circumstances, and then you have, there were charges in there that were considered that sort of add to the time, but he wasn't actually charged or convicted of those particular crimes. This is fascinating to me, Tom, because this is a process that goes on whether there is a jury trial or even when there is a plea agreement that's done. And a lot of times what will happen with plea agreements is some of those charges get dropped as part of the plea bargain. So you may have 18 counts initially, and it gets dropped down to just three charges in the end. And it's a little mind-boggling, but it is true that, hey, you've got some factors in there that really should be considered when you're being sentenced, but the court is not permitted to consider those things. One of the other things is they talked about him entering into marriage at an early age, and he became a father to his son, Sean. And he did take on the responsibility of raising his son after that marriage ended. Boo-hoo, isn't that what you're supposed to do as a father?
Unbelievable.
So they're coming in saying it's a mitigating circumstance.
Duty, right. Okay.
Right. And despite, you know, all of that, he maintained this strong bond with his son. So it's almost comical sometimes to read these things. He also disclosed to probation that he had significant issues with alcohol. And of course, he's thinking that probably contributed to his legal problems and the fact that he had difficulties in his relationships with women. That's what we're calling abuse now, Tom, difficulties.
Right. He actually received substantial support from his family and friends, as evidenced by the letters attached to his submission. These really heartfelt letters came from his son, his brother, and his father, showcasing the network of support that he actually had around him. With this support and the supervision of the court, he believed he could be rehabilitated and avoid reoffending. Now, Michael did acknowledge the gravity of his offense and the need for punishment, but he really wanted an opportunity, or I should say he claimed to want an opportunity, to become a productive member of society and provide some restitution. He wanted to re-enter the workforce upon release and believed that working and making restitution payments would be more beneficial than spending more time in jail, recommended by the probation department.
Of course.
Of course. Well, nobody wants to go to jail for longer, so that makes perfect sense. Now, in light of these factors, the defense asked the court to impose a sentence at the lower end of the guideline range and then have a 3-year period of suspended release. They also requested that Ferrari Mike be placed in a correctional facility close to his son in Atlanta, Georgia, and be given the opportunity to participate in a residential drug abuse program to address his issues while he is incarcerated.
I can't help but think to myself when I hear some of these arguments, when you say, for example, hey, I'm looking forward to being a productive member of society when I get out, and I think that I'll do well and I won't reoffend because I've got all this support of my family and friends. I mean, didn't he have that support before when he was offending? Why wasn't he gainfully employed before?
He has an attorney. His attorney has this legal and moral obligation to zealously advocate for his client. The client is a crook. He's been a crook his entire life. So he has to pick out what little gems he had or little explanations that he can find to try to do the best in his client's interest. And you know what? To you and I and a reasonable person, it doesn't sound legitimate. Absolutely. But he's really just, the attorney's trying to do the best for his client, even though, because there really isn't much there, to be honest. I mean, he's been a crook most of his life.
I guess my mind just drifts into, they could have made those lies a lot better if they're going to and argue for those things. The other thing that they were really objecting to had to do with the allegations of abuse. They were arguing that the allegations lacked reliability, but the defense was really mistaken about that. The allegations came from multiple women. They were consistent across the boards, physical and emotional abuse by Ferrari Mike. There were photographs of bruises that were presented as further evidence that were supporting the women's claims. And it wasn't only the women who reported instances of abuse. The defendant's former driver and bodyguard also saw him physically assaulting his wife on more than one occasion. And he also objected to including losses that were incurred by the Michael S. Investor Group in the restitution amount. And I can't help but think that's got to be so offensive to have ripped somebody off and then in open court argue that you shouldn't include those losses. The law clearly states that restitution should be ordered for victims that are harmed by someone's criminal conduct in the course of a scheme or a pattern. And of course, this was a pattern. This was a scheme that was included criminal activity, and the victims from the Michael S. Investor Group should be included in the restitution amount that was ordered by the court.
Now, he also objected to certain conditions of the supervised release. For example, he objected to the warrantless search condition and the alcohol restriction. Now, it's curious about the alcohol restriction, since he said he was going to get alcohol treatment. Well, then why would that be an issue? But you know what? That's okay. We'll just keep going.
Right.
Now, it's important to note, though, the court has discretion in imposing conditions to protect the public and prevent recidivism. Similar conditions have been upheld in previous cases, and they're always tailored to address the specific risks posed by the defendant.
Let's talk about that, Tom. I think that's so true, right? It's to protect the public.
Yeah. Right.
Think about what is supervised release. It's not just simply checking in with a probation officer occasionally. It's that you also have to abide by these guidelines. The what they call a fourth waiver, your Fourth Amendment right to unlawful search and seizure does not apply when you're on probation, when you're on a supervised release, and that is to prevent recidivism. If you know that you're walking down the street and any law enforcement officer can search your person or they can search your vehicle or your home, that you're less likely then to repeat offenses. So I can't help but think, why would you not want that warrantless search condition?
And with the alcohol restriction, he claimed that the alcohol contributed to his problems, which is why he said he was going to get treatment for it. So it would make sense that the court would say, okay, in order to protect the public, since you said the alcohol was a contributing factor to your behavior, we're going to restrict it.
Yeah, let's help you out.
Now, the government, all right, asked the court to impose a sentence of 63 months imprisonment, 3 years of supervised release, no fine, but restitution in an amount close to $3 million. Now, it seems that the defendant wants to change. That's what he's claiming. But this really cannot change the fact about the crimes he has already committed. We mentioned this before, but two young boys, just 17 years old, were manipulated and exploited by him for his own gain. He didn't care about their well-being or their dreams that the family had for them. It was all about him and what he could get from them. And this case wasn't one where the defendant had a glimmer of hope or intent to actually make the investment or business work. This was pure fraud from the beginning. He didn't care who he hurt, as long as he could drive his fancy cars, which he leased but pretended to own, live in a luxurious house, which he rented but pretended he owned. The impact on the victims was really heart-wrenching. The parents of one of the boys, who were once happily married, were now forced to live in different states just to find work. They could only see each other for short visits a few times a year. And their son, who was part of the musical duo High Life, and dedicated his teenage years to the defendant's charade, actually abandoned his musical dreams, which frankly is really upsetting, and was now simply working a temp job, trying to find some direction in life after music. The other boy, it gets worse, turned to alcohol, and both of them were left feeling lost, angry, scared, depressed. Their lives had turned in the wrong direction, thanks to Ferrari Mike.
I see that as ripples on a pond.
Yes.
You know, he's got this huge web of victims that are just kind of left in his wake. And he has the nerve to try to con the court into a lower sentence, into saying that there wasn't as much loss as it seemed to be, and that it was only due to unfortunate circumstances in his own life. And remember, there were other victims as well, because it didn't just stop with the musical artists. Remember, he had approached these investors. He was, Gerald S., for example, had convinced his family and friends to invest in the non-existent music deals. And to your point, Tom, he never intended to even try to make that work at all. He just took the money and spent it. And Gerald S. in particular had lost some really important relationships that he had built throughout his life. His marriage was severely affected. He and his wife had to spend a lot more time working. They had less time to spend with their young daughters. So there just is no denying the ripple effects that this guy's fraud caused so much financial, emotional, traumatic, psychological damage. And that's going to continue to haunt his victims long after Ferrari Mike is finally sentenced to prison. So all in all, what we learn from Ferrari Mike is that he is a manipulative con artist. He shows no signs of being able to control his instincts to lie, take other people's money. There's no remorse. You can't see any remorse through his statements or his actions. There's just no sympathy for his victims, while not only he was engaging in the act, but in trying to advocate for himself in terms of what an appropriate punishment is. And it, over 5 years, he operated that fraudulent scheme. He preyed upon dozens of people and defrauded them out of close to $3 million. And again, these were vulnerable people because they were sharing their dreams and their hopes with him. And it was just all used to fund his own selfish desires.
So let's tell everyone what happened, Dom. He got 78 months. My opinion, not enough, to be honest. I feel like he should be in prison for a much longer time. But that's what the judge decided. That's what he got in our system. And that's what it is. Now, looking at this case, I think it really serves as a cautionary tale about the dark side of the music industry, where dreams can easily be shattered by con artists like him. But it doesn't just happen in the music industry. It can happen anywhere. He swindled fellow sheriff's deputies. These scams can happen anywhere to anyone, and they happen all too often. People have hopes and dreams, and these types of people like Ferrari Mike prey on them. Even in Hollywood, where countless people flock each year to pursue their dreams, there are people waiting to take advantage of it. And there you have it, the gripping tale of the devastating consequences inflicted by Michael Banuelos' fraudulent schemes. It's been a roller coaster, unveiling layers of deceit and unbelievable impacts on the lives of innocent people who deserve so much better.
And I think that's all we have time for today, Tom.
Well, thank you everyone for listening. We're grateful you decided to join us today, and we hope you consider subscribing to the show and even sharing it with some friends who could use a tax crime junkie podcast in their life. Help us spread the word and come back for more.
We hope you'll join us again next week as we continue our mission to find the loopholes that went left and close them for good. Until next time, remember that every crime has a trail that leads to the truth.